Top Democrats say more hearings could be coming on the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. That's after a marathon week with 9 people testifying about the White House's dealings with Ukraine. So what have we learned so far and what happens next? Here to help us break it all down is Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, WBUR legal analyst, and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thanks for being with us.
Always good to be here.
So tons to digest from the last 2 weeks, multiple days, wall-to-wall coverage of the public hearings. Now that you've had a couple of days to reflect, what most sticks out to you about what you heard in those public hearings?
Well, the consistency of the story. There are a couple of things. One is when the Republicans say there's no direct evidence, you know, the judge in me goes up in arms. There is direct evidence here. There are the statements that the president made in the July phone call. There's the statements that were overheard. But in addition, there is a web of the conspiracy that Mueller found lacking. We have here, and very explicitly, the conspiracy of people who were implementing what the president wanted, which means that their statements can be taken against him. That's what happens.
So are you saying there's collusion this time around?
Yes, that's right. Although collusion is not a legal term, but in a conspiracy to, you know, distribute drugs, the guy who at the direction of the leader arranges for the transportation and gets the money, his statements count against the leader. In addition, you're always held responsible for the statements of your agent. Giuliani's statements are countable, are admissible against the president. There is a huge amount of evidence here, and the stories are actually, for the most part, totally consistent. And that's so interesting, because notwithstanding the different positions that people were in the embassy, in the national security apparatus, they nevertheless told a really perfectly consistent story.
And just to be very clear, what does constitute direct evidence?
Direct evidence would be, I can quote your statements now. You're in front of me. You are, I could cross-examine you if I didn't, you know, if I wanted to. And your statements then comprise direct evidence of your state of mind. When you report to somebody else what your state of mind, and there's actually a theory of admissibility for that as well. When you tell your co-conspirators what's going on and they testify, that is arguably hearsay, but there's an exception for that. So a co-conspirator could testify. You tell your agent to do something, the agent's words can come in against you. If we didn't have the conspiracy laws and the agency laws, then, you know, then essentially all the sort of drug kingpins would have walked away. But so there's direct, and all of that is direct evidence. Circumstantial evidence is evidence where you know the underpinnings of the facts and the inferences are clear. And so, for example, at one point, Sondland said, I knew that the aid was cut off. I didn't know why. Nobody could give me an explanation. And it was going on at the same time at these discussions of, you know, if Zelensky doesn't announce investigations, he can't come to the White House.
This is Gordon Sondland, the EU ambassador.
He drew an inference, which any reasonable jury or reasonable decision maker would draw, that the two were connected. There was no other explanation.
So it sounds like you might argue that there is sufficient evidence to file articles of impeachment in the House today.
I think that there is sufficient evidence. The analogy here is as if, you know, Mayor Walsh decided to withhold funding for the police unless they, you know, endorsed him in the next election.
Marty Walsh is not going to like that analogy today.
but it really is. It's the notion of playing around with security funds for an ally in the midst of a war, not for the purposes of ferreting out corruption, but for the purposes of enlisting Ukraine in the president's own personal political bandwagon.
So what about the argument, and there are supporters of the president who are clearly making this argument, that whether it happened or not does not mean that it rises to the category of an impeachable offense?
Well, you know, that is a political judgment, but you can only look at analogies. This is, unlike Clinton, for example, this is using the levers of power for your own personal end. I can't think of anything else that would, if, I mean, really, as Schiff said, if this is not impeachable, what is? What would, you know, if this isn't impeachable, what is?
All right. So you and I were talking before the show about the fact that we are imminently awaiting a judgment by a federal court about whether or not former White House counsel Don McGahn is required to appear after being called to testify. Can you, what's at stake there and why is it important?
Well, it is unheard of for a witness to ignore a lawful subpoena, totally ignore it. Typically what happens, in fact, I can't think of a situation where it didn't happen, is the witness comes to court to claim whatever privileges he or she has. The witness never fails to appear in court. This is really casting disrepute on the White House in a fundamental way. So what the judge is likely to say is, McGahn, you have to appear before Congress. You may have privilege issues that you will assert, conversations with the president that fit under executive privilege. You may have that, but you can't not appear.
So that would have implications then for other people like acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, for example,
right,
and others who have been subpoenaed and have literally just not walked into the hearing.
Right. I mean, Mulvaney and Bolton in particular, and Bolton is the interesting character here because Bolton carries with him the national security Republican establishment in a way that no one else does.
You what do you mean by that?
Well, you can't look at John Bolton and say this is a never-Trumper. If he testifies, his testimony will be on behalf of a very substantial part of the Republican Party.
And he's the former national security advisor and served under other Republican administrations,
right,
as
and,
well.
And he believes in a robust, I mean, one can disagree with what he believes in, but he certainly, you know, mirrors a certain portion of the Republican Party. Let me say also, by the way, that arguably things that the president says to his attorney, or arguably his attorney, may fit within a privilege, but the things that the president tells people to tell others is not ever privileged. So if, for example, President Trump tells McGahn, or better yet, tells Giuliani, tell Zelensky, the head of Ukraine, X or Y, that's never privileged because it's not confidential. It fits into the category of orders that were given. So they can provide direct evidence of the orders that were given by this president with respect to Ukraine.
Staying with the law for a minute longer, and then we'll do one or two things on the politics as well. Rudy Giuliani, you referred to him earlier in our conversation as the president's agent. Is there a level of legal exposure for him now that's become more urgent? There's some discussion about an interview he gave with CNN where he quipped about having insurance in case the president ran over him with a bus. Is he at risk now personally?
I think he's at substantial risk. He's already made it clear that in his activities in Ukraine, he was not acting as the president's lawyer, even, and that it wouldn't be cover what he did in any event. You can't claim to be acting as someone's lawyer and then do things that are not lawyer-like and have nothing to do with a pending case, but is political. So no, he has enormous exposure for what he did at the president's behest, and then there is exposure for the ways in which he was wrapped up in what the two individuals who were recently indicted are also doing.
The Ukrainian American
they are. And he certainly, and we don't know the extent of that exposure. All I can say about that is the sloppiness of his language, if that mirrors the sloppiness of his acts, I would be very concerned were I his lawyer.
So you've pointed out today and other times that impeachment is a political process. It's not a legal process. So even if the House does file articles of impeachment, the Senate doesn't necessarily have to try the president. A new poll from the Hill shows that independents are souring on the inquiry. Is it politically a smart strategy to keep going?
I can't answer that because having lived through the Nixon impeachment, there certainly were souring moments during the course of that. And then all of a sudden, information comes out, which suddenly changes the equation completely. But really, apart from that, and maybe this is the judge in me, this conduct has to be announced as wrong. I understand the potential consequence, but it has to be announced as wrong, not just unpopular, but really wrong.
That's Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, WBUR legal analyst, and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thanks for spending the time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Boston's Black Radical, the story of William Monroe Trotter and his newspaper, The Guardian. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.